Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Many of you know I am former legislative counsel to Congressman Barney Frank. I've been on the radio for 12 years now. God, I'm getting old. Hate that. And I've been a citizen activist since I was 5. I really have been. I've been focusing, protesting, fighting the power since at least I was 5 years old. And I want to talk this hour about my own history of activism, of protest, of fighting the powers that be, of challenging things that I didn't see were right. And I want to hear your stories as well of things that you've done, ways that you've fought the power, ways that you have challenged something when everybody thought you were wrong. I actually could say that my first activism, I can't even take credit for because it occurred before my birth. But it occurred in my family, and damn it, I want to take credit for it, so I'm going to try. And it has to do with the 1964 Mississippi Freedom Summer. You could learn about that one in history classes. It was before I was born. But it occurred in Mississippi when hundreds of activists, probably thousands, from all across the country came to Mississippi to register black people to vote. Now, Mississippi, like most Jim Crow states, indeed probably the most severe Jim Crow state. I never know. Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, they're kind of fighting for worst of the worst. But Mississippi may well have been the worst of the worst. And Mississippi, of course, did not allow its black citizens to vote. It put all kinds of impossible roadblocks in their path, everything from counting the jelly beans in a jar to counting the bubbles on a bar of soap, to reading and understanding all the parts of the Constitution by untrained people. And let's face it, 99% of white Mississippians couldn't answer those questions either. To poll taxes, literacy tests, you get the whole thing. Well, in 1964, with the aid of the Civil Rights Movement, great leaders like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and others, they encouraged Mississippians to register, to vote, particularly black Mississippians, and a number of people from the North and from elsewhere across the country came to help them to register. My aunt, my mother's sister, grew up along with my mom in Nashville, Tennessee. Actually, they grew up originally in Mississippi, ironically. My mom grew up in Mississippi till she was 7. My aunt was older till she was about 11 or so, and then they moved to Nashville. So they grew up in the South. And my grandfather, who had some women's clothing stores, was very careful to not discriminate in the ways that so many others did in the South. He had blacks in his stores. He had whites in his stores. My grandfather very much believed in treating people equally. When the 1960s rolled around, my aunt had already moved out of the house. She'd gone to college. She was living up in New York City, and she was every bit the stereotypical hippie. She had a VW microbus. You remember those? God, I got to be a certain age, I guess, to remember those. Maybe some of you have seen them on TV. VW microbus with New York plates. She had hair down, I don't know, to her knees. I'm probably exaggerating. Which I wouldn't be surprised. I think it was below her waist. Her husband had a long beard and bushy hair. They were the classic hippies, and they were coming down from New York City to register blacks in Mississippi with their VW microbus and the New York plates. And it was almost like a movie, you can imagine. They went through Nashville, my hometown where I was born, where my grandfather and the rest of my family lived, my grandmother. And they told my grandfather of the plan, and he didn't want them to go. And this is my liberal grandfather, the one who really taught me a lot of my liberal values. And he agreed that blacks needed to vote. He agreed with registration of them. He agreed that segregation was wrong. But he'd just seen that 3 kids had died. You may well know about the Mississippi Three, Schwerner and Cheney and Goodman, a black kid from Mississippi and two white Jewish kids from the North. And he was very concerned that my aunt and uncle, the Jewish kids from the North with their long hair and VW microbus, were just the perfect target for firebombing. If you know the story of the Mississippi Three, you know that they were actually trapped and killed by the police. The police actually stopped them, put their lights on, pulled them over, and of course you don't really refuse when the police pull you over, and then turned them over to the local Klan who murdered them. So it's a very, very dangerous thing when the police are out to kill you. And my grandfather said, you know, I don't want you to have any part of it. And my aunt said, but Daddy, she said to her father, these are your values. And he said, yes, they're my values. But first and foremost among my values is not to get killed. So they argued about it for a while. And she made clear she was going down there, whether he said she could or not. She was an adult. She could do what she wanted. And he said, I don't want you dead. And they finally came to what I really think was a great common sense, practical solution. They decided that she would go down with her husband in his car, my grandfather's car, a Tennessee car. I don't know what kind of car it was. I'm sure it was not a VW microbus. It was probably like a Oldsmobile or Chevrolet or something. Big old car with Tennessee plates. And they would go down and they would register black people, but they wouldn't stand out like a sore thumb in a car that said, firebomb me. And they went down and they registered a number of people to vote and came back. And I've always been very, very proud of my aunt's story. But I'm also proud of my grandfather's story. Not just my aunt for having the idealism and the courage to go down and help her fellow Americans. I'm certainly very proud of her. But not only her. I'm proud of my grandfather for recognizing practical difficulties and for finding pragmatic solutions. Right? It's not enough to live your ideals. I mean, I certainly oppose Vladimir Putin. I think he's a dangerous guy. Kim Jong-il is, I forget what, Kim Il-sung, who's the dictator of Kim?
Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un, thank you. You know, the dictator of South Korea, with the Kims, Kim Jong-un. North Korea, exactly. Did I just say South Korea? I'm tired today. North Korea, Kim Jong-un's dictator, is a horrible, horrible human being who runs a very, very dangerous police state. But if I went to North Korea and tried to kill Kim Jong-un, I would quickly be murdered and I would have achieved nothing. And one of the things I strongly believe is that as much as it would be a good thing to kill this vicious dictator and to free the people of North Korea, I'm not stupid enough to believe that I could accomplish it, or even that, frankly, our government could accomplish it in any way, shape, or form that would be beneficial to mankind. Sometimes you can have the right idealistic idea and not the right way to achieve it. I feel the same way, by the way, for all of you who vote for third parties because you think the Democrats have moved too far to the right. I say vote in primaries. Move the Democratic Party in a progressive direction. That's terrific. That's fantastic. But when you vote for a third party, you really are hurting the party that you're closest to. And, of course, we all know those Ralph Nader voters who got George Bush close enough to the election that when Al Gore beat him by a relatively small margin, the United States Supreme Court could steal the election in 2000. But I digress. The point is of the story of my aunt that occurred before I was born is that, to me, that's in my blood, this mixture of idealism, but practical idealism, not the kind of idealism. And this is something also that Barney Frank used to talk about, my former boss. He was, of course, many of you know, a very, very talented legislator, congressman from Massachusetts, rose up to be even chairman of the Financial Services Committee, I did a judiciary, Homeland Security measures. But Barney Frank always talked about the fact. He also, by the way, is always voted the most brilliant man in Congress. Barney always talked about the fact that just going to protest, just marching in the streets may make you feel good. But basically, the more it makes you feel good, the less it's likely to be successful. That really the hard work of getting progressive legislation passed is behind the scenes, working it, talking with people you disagree with, finding some kind of compromise that moves the ball forward, and going out when they don't compromise and attacking them publicly, but using it as a means to an end. Complaining loudly is never an end. It's a means to an end. And Barney Frank did that really well. And so the story of my aunt and my grandfather, to me, reminds me that every idealist idea, no matter how fantastic and great an idea it is, such as registering black people in the 60s, it should be tempered by pragmatism wherever possible. So my history of citizen activism, as I said, began when I was 5 years old. I learned when I was five that cigarettes can kill you. I forgot how I learned it, but I learned it. Maybe I saw it on TV. I'm not sure. But my mother used to smoke a pack a day, white Kent cigarettes. And one day, when she was not looking, I saw an entire carton of Kent cigarettes. A carton, I think, is 12 or 24 packs of cigarettes. I'm not sure. But I do know that I took the entire carton, never opened, took every cigarette, and over the toilet, because I didn't want to make a mess, I broke every single cigarette in two. And flushed them down the toilet. Well, I may have stopped up the toilet. I don't remember. But what I do remember is that when my mom found out what I'd done and asked me why I did it, I started crying and said I didn't want her to die. That's a great way to avoid punishment. But it wasn't why I did it. It was sincere. I truly did not want my mom to die. By the way, my mom is living and she's fantastic and she's a wonderful, wonderful mother. But I really feared for her, and I wanted to show her through action that I wanted her to stop smoking. She didn't stop there and then, but I will say this. Over the course of my childhood, I used civil disobedience. Again, I didn't know what these words meant, but I certainly did use civil disobedience. It got to the point where every time my mom would walk in my room with a cigarette, I would walk out. She'd walk in my bedroom, I'd be in bed, I would get up, and I would walk out of the room. And soon, it became an unwritten rule. She would never, ever, ever smoke in front of me. And that was a start. Again, I didn't get exactly what I wanted, her to quit smoking, not at the outset. But at the beginning, she just wouldn't smoke in front of me, which is good, because I hate cigarettes. I cough in them. My eyes water. I get a sore throat. I hate being around cigarettes. It got to the point where later on, she would hide in the bathroom. And then the ostracism, it wasn't just me. And that's the thing about movements, right? You can't do them by yourself. While I was pushing her at home, whenever she was at meetings, and she was very active in the local synagogue, and she would go to meetings, and they would tell her, don't smoke in front of us. And she'd have to go outside and furtively puff some. And I think the combination of ostracism at home and wherever she went out, plus the fact that she's a smart lady and she knew that cigarettes do kill you. One-third of all tobacco users die from tobacco use. Eventually got my mom to quit. And around the time I was in high school, she did quit. I'm very, very proud of her because I know it's the most it's the most addictive drug known to man. It's very, very hard to quit. Do not ever start smoking cigarettes, please, if you listen to my voice, if you have a choice in the matter. It's very, very addictive, far more addictive than marijuana or alcohol or any other drug, more addictive than heroin or cocaine. Nicotine's extremely dangerous. Don't do it. 400,000 Americans die a year. But I learned that sometimes when something is not right, even if you're 5 years old, you can try to make it right. And I'll tell you my next example of citizen activism. That's what I thought. I just want to go through my life and give you my examples of citizen activism, but I want to hear yours as well. What have you done in your life? Could be as a kid, as an adult, where all the forces were arrayed against you. You were powerless, but you went out. You took a stand. Everyone thought you were wrong. You took a stand, and you made a change for the better for your life or someone else. That's what I want to hear. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Look, back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, laying out my history of citizen activism. I don't know that I'll finish it in an hour, but that's okay, because I want to hear from you, your history of activism, large or small. And I'm beginning small. I'm beginning when I was small. I told you my first protest at age 5 and how it was successful. Now, again, this was a protest to keep my mom from smoking cigarettes, and it was successful. It took me about close to 15 years, but more than a decade. Actually, most of my great successes have taken more than a decade, but I'm proud to say my mom is alive and well and off the evil tobacco, and I think that largely it was my persistence and my dedication and my sincerity and a lot of hard work on her part, to be sure, and a lot of hard work on others persuading her to take that off. I want to tell you about my next one, and then I'll get to your calls probably after the half-hour break. The next time that I remember doing something protest-like was when I was 8 years old. Now, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and Nashville, Tennessee certainly is not it's more progressive than much of the South, but it is the South and certainly somewhat conservative. And of course, I grew up in the 1970s, so it was certainly not as progressive back then. But when I was 8 years old, I was invited by a friend of mine to go to the Belle Meade Country Club. Now, Belle Meade is a very exclusive area of Nashville, Tennessee. It is an area where, certainly at that time, the richest people lived. It was an area that, for a long period of time, had something called restrictive covenants. And those were compacts among landholders to not sell their property to people who did not belong in that neighborhood. Generally, that was Jews and Blacks. And Jews and Blacks could not buy homes in Belle Meade. And true to this, to its form, the Belle Meade Country Club did not allow Jewish or Black members into the Belle Meade Country Club. Now, I didn't know that. And my friend was a child of someone who went to the Belle Meade Country Club and invited me in as a guest, and I was there with him in the swimming pool because I like to swim. And while I was in the swimming pool, I learned from my fellow 8-year-old friend that the Belle Meade Country Club did not allow Blacks or Jews into membership in the club. And I said, well, why am I here? Because I'm Jewish. And he said, well, you know, we didn't really tell anyone you were Jewish and you're here as a guest. And so, you know, you're in here. And I said, well, what would happen if a Black kid jumped at the pool? And he said, I'm sure everyone would get out. And I was stunned. This was absolutely stunning to my 8-year-old ears. I had definitely Black friends. In fact, my first girlfriend was Black. I was stunned to think that people would be so close-minded that they would jump out of a pool. And I said to him, take me home. I don't want to be here. And he's like, well, you know, it's okay. Nothing's happened. I'm like, just take me home. Somehow at age 8, I knew that was wrong. And you know what? I haven't been back to the Bummy Country Club since. Now they allow Blacks and Jews in, but I still don't want to go there. That was my second activist moment. What was yours? What's particularly your early activism? Maybe something you did as a kid. What's some kind of protest or something you took, some stand you took for justice or progressive values? Let me know. 888-48-MARK, right back after this for your call. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Mark and Grimaldi and I have been just telling tales of childhood. You know, I think this all started when last Friday I was arguing that kids have a right to play outside and that parents can be a little too paranoid about protecting their kids from things that turn out to be really, really bad. And now I've been talking, Mark's been talking about our protests beginning as little kids. And I was just thinking about my next protest that occurred at age 13. But I want to hear from you first. I want to know where you've protested, where you've been successful, where you failed. You don't just have to give me successful. Listen, about half my protests have failed. My 8-year-old protest, I didn't stop the Bummy Country Club from discriminating. So, you know, but I made a point for myself. Where have you protested? Where have you fought the power? Why and did you succeed? Let's hear your stories of citizen activism. Let's go to John in Santa Fe on line five. Hey, John, how are you?
Yeah, I'm not a liberal, and this is a liberal town, and whenever I see one of these really offensive signs on businesses that say no firearms allowed on premises, I remove that sign.
Well, that's illegal.
I'm all about people being able to exercise their fundamental rights wherever they may be.
And you think you have the right to carry a gun onto someone else's property?
Well, in the same way that I have a right to be a Jew or a Christian on someone else's property, I have a right to carry a gun on someone else's property.
Really? Really? How about a torch, a lit torch? You should be able to bring that
liberals
on someone's property.
Liberals are the most absolutely closed-minded group of people I've ever met.
What about a lit torch? Is that okay? Bring on someone's property? In a library, maybe? Is that okay or not? I just wonder where your freedom begins and ends. What do you think? John? Did John hang up? Oh, I guess I asked him a too tough a question. I think it's fair.
Not that hard. You know what? That's when you know you stumped someone.
Yeah, no, I mean,
really. You should be able to bring a lit torch, click.
A simple question. I mean, you know, if you can bring a firearm onto someone's property when they have a sign that says no firearms allowed.
How can you say someone's closed-minded and then you hang up on them?
I don't know, but, you know, can you bring a lit torch into a library? That's just a simple question. He could give me an answer, yes or no, and we would continue the discussion from there. But that's really disturbing. When I think about my protests, I did destroy property when it came to my mom's cigarettes. But it was my mom's property. It wasn't someone else's property. But to basically remove a no firearms allowed sign, you know, I wouldn't forget firearms. If someone had something that said no food in here, let's think about something a lot less scary than firearms. If no food allowed, I wouldn't remove the sign and I wouldn't bring food in to someone else's private property where it says no food allowed, much less guns, because it's their property. They have an absolute right to say no food allowed or no shirts, no shoes, no service. You ever seen those signs? I wouldn't walk into such a place without a shirt and shoes. And if I did by accident and I didn't see the sign and they asked me to leave, I would leave and I wouldn't feel bad. I don't think that's quite the same as no Jews, no blacks, no service. I kind of think those are different things. And that doesn't even have to deal with guns. You know, maybe this guy, I don't know, maybe he's going to walk into his Santa Fe. That's the state capital in New Mexico. I'm quite confident firearms aren't allowed there. Is he going to walk into the state capital? I don't even want to, you know what, I shouldn't even suggest something because he could be listening on the air. But, okay. That took a turn. But, folks, let me tell you something. I don't care how crazy your ideas are. If you call in and I disagree with you, that's fine. But then let's continue the dialogue because I want you to think about what you're saying. And I want to know where it ends and where it begins. And if you've got some idea, I think it's fair to answer some questions about it. Don't you? All right, let's go to other stories of citizen activism. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Chris in New Mexico, line two. How are you, sir?
Very good. Nice job with the last guy, by the way.
Thank you. I thought it was a fair question. I mean, you know, a lit torch into a library. I mean, again, I wouldn't even bring food in a place where there's no food allowed. But, you know, sneaking in food where no food is allowed seems to me a little less, scary than sneaking in a gun and removing a sign. Oh, whatever. Anyway, go ahead. Chris, tell me your stories of citizen activism, protests.
Well, when I was 19, I protested the Vietnam War while I was serving in the United States military.
Ooh, boy, wow. Did you do it in uniform? Because that's illegal, I'm pretty sure.
I did it in uniform. I did it. I turned in paperwork and the whole bit. I didn't do it as a conscientious objector, although I was objecting to what I started to realize was a really, really bad idea, the war itself. And my punishment for the whole thing was I was reassigned to work on a Navy horse ranch.
Huh. Now,
so
you were court-martialed.
I wrote a book about it.
Huh. Now, you weren't court-martialed or anything like that, but you were assigned to work on a ranch.
I wound up, what they tried to do instantly was bust me for drugs. And so when they searched my car, they found what they thought was a seed.
A seed.
So for the next 2 years, Yeah, I was in legal hold for 2 years over a seed.
Over a seed. And, well, did they do forensic testing? I mean, was this an oak seed or was it a cannabis seed? Did they?
Was it a sesame seed?
I mean, come on, seeds are.
I'm thinking it was a cannabis seed that had been smoked out, and it was probably there wasn't enough residue to put in a test tube. So but I wound up with an honorable discharge after all was said and done. And a great experience working on that horse ranch in the Navy, and I got to express my ideas to other people who are coming.
And it's a lot better than serving in Vietnam, to be sure.
The idea was secondary. I went in thinking the only reason we hadn't won the war was because I hadn't been there yet. And the truth came to me in the words of people who were coming back from over there, and they were telling me about the atrocities that they were seeing happen, and it was just turned my head around, and I had to do something about it.
Gotcha. Well, thanks for your call. I appreciate that.
Read the book.
I'll check out the book. Let's go to Taj.
It's.
Oh yeah. What's the title of the book?
It's called The Ranch.
The Ranch. All right, fair enough. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Tajira in Massachusetts on line one. Hey, Tajira, how are you?
Yes, hi. Mark, yeah, I have kind of an interesting story.
Yeah.
It's a little violent, but nothing horrible.
Well, it's the truth. Just tell it to me. 10 years old, okay?
Well, definitely. I was 10 years old in grade school, and there was this boy, and he was basically doing what nowadays would be called sexual harassment, but this was in 1973.
Okay.
And there weren't a lot of school policies about it, and without being too explicit, he was, we wore short skirts then because it was the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and he was poking girls under the table with rulers. Yeah. Really bad. So
bad boy.
Very bad boy. So me and this other young lady, we went up to the teacher, who was a female teacher,
mm-hmm.
and we said to her, you know, ma'am, this boy is poking us. And I actually used the word, I don't know if you could say it on the radio, vagina.
Yeah,
because
that
I was
word you could say.
Medical.
You're allowed to say that word, just don't use any.
Okay.
Any
oh, topic. I would use a swear. See, I was right. brought up not to swear. I was brought up to use the medical term.
That's yeah, no, the medical term is perfectly word. Fine. It's a realistic term. It's true. It's
yes,
not.
It is.
It's a real word. Anyway, go ahead. So you said that they were.
The teacher, well, first of all, she was shocked that I used that word. She looked at me like I was saying some dirty word.
Right.
And I said, you know, this boy is poking the girls in the vagina, and we're going to lose our virginity from this guy. And if he keeps up doing this, I'm going to punch him.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher was like, oh, she kind of like blew it off, and she said, oh, I'll talk to him after class. And in the meanwhile, he's still continuing to poke the girls under the table.
Ooh.
She didn't even move him to another table or
Ooh.
Anything.
You said this said this was Catholic school? Is that what you said?
No, this is not a Catholic school.
Just a public
school?
It's
a regular public school.
All right, okay.
Yeah. So what I did was I chokeslammed him against the wall. And I was a little skinny, scrawny, runty kid, but I'd had enough, and I told the teacher, if this keeps up and you don't do anything, I'm going to punch him. So I did, and the other girls were like, yay, yay. And I think I headbutted him. I'm not sure, but I gave him a bloody nose, and I immediately got detention, and then the teacher's like, and, you know, don't tell your mom and dad why you got detention exactly. Just say it was for fighting, because she was afraid that they would find out what had happened with the boy and that she hadn't disciplined him.
Oh, so she's afraid of getting in trouble. So you told your parents
the truth,
I'm sure.
Well, I told my parents immediately, and so did the other two girls that he was poking.
You had witnesses. Yeah.
Yes, we had witnesses. Yes, well, they were cheering me when I did it.
Uh-huh.
And so basically, you know, the folks went and talked to the teacher, and she was not fired or disciplined, which I was kind of disappointed at that. She still continued to teach.
Mm.
And it was very strange. They didn't have a policy against sexual harassment then. So I had to stand up physically against bullying, which normally I don't recommend to children nowadays, because there are other methods, and I don't really think that people should fight in school. But I did give the teacher fair warning, and
I did not think
it was right.
Yeah.
You know, and I do encourage young girls to learn self-defense and that too, because you cannot always rely on authority figures to protect you, whether it's in grade school or at university.
It's unfortunate.
You know, you have to stand up for yourself.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that's one of the reasons why when I fight authority, it's because when authority isn't protecting the most vulnerable, then it's authority is the danger and not just the person doing the harm. So good for you.
Oh, here's the funniest part. I did tell you the funny part, though.
Yeah.
She then scolded my parents for teaching me to say vagina.
Because somehow that was worse than him poking you there.
Yeah. She said, what kind of books do you allow her to read?
Oh, my God.
Words like vagina. And so
what else are you going to call a body part? I mean, you know.
My mom was a very ladylike woman, but she said right out, oh, you'd rather have her say.
Another word. Yeah, don't say it on the air.
Yeah, she can't say. And the teacher was like, well, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, I hear you. Thanks for your call, Tajira. I appreciate you sharing your story. I'll tell you something. John from Santa Fe has called. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, John from Santa Fe has called back. He's the one that called in and said, oh, no, I was going to get to you, John. All right, John, I want you to call. Well, during the break, I want you to call back. Now, John called in and said that his civil disobedience, his protest, is removing signs that say no firearms on the premises. He actually said, and again, I hope he'll call back in because he's hung up twice now. But John said in Santa Fe that he removes signs that say no firearms on premises. Now, what he didn't say is, does he go ahead and then bring a gun on the premises, or he just removes the signs? But somehow he thinks that it impinges on his freedom for a private business to say they don't want guns on their property. He compared it, in fact, to my example of a country club that excluded blacks and Jews. He considers not being allowed to bring a gun on private property to be equivalent to racial or religious discrimination. I asked him a very nice question back. I just want to know how far it went. I asked if he should be allowed to bring a lit torch into a library, and he hung up. But he said it's because he didn't mean to. He accidentally disconnected. He was turning up the volume of his phone, disconnected. So in the break, John, please call back, and let's have a civil discussion. I want to know where you're coming from, because it's I don't get it, but I really want you to have a chance to explain where you're coming from, because it seems really weird to me. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. You can also call in and tell me your own personal history of citizen activism, protest, or civil disobedience. Right back after this.
He's a Harvard economist and a Yale lawyer. He does not keep up with the Kardashians. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. We're trying a third time with John from Santa Fe. And John, I got to tell you, I do appreciate your calling back. Sorry you accidentally hung up. I do want you to explain to me why you think it was the right thing to do to remove signs from private businesses that say no firearms on the premises. All right. John, I'm sorry.
His line did just drop, so it's got to be something wrong.
All right. I'll tell you what, John. I'm here every day, every weekday. I ain't going nowhere. I'm here between 3 and 4. If you get a phone that works, I want to hear from you. Break in. We could be talking about some other topic. As long as you call in early enough, you know, before we run out of time. Between 3 and 4 p.m. It's actually, excuse me, Mountain Time. You're in Santa Fe, so that's 1 to 2 p.m. Call in. I literally want to hear this story. I think it's pretty wild, and I want you to have a chance to explain yourself, so I encourage you to do that. While we're waiting for John to try one more time to call back, or if you want to call in to tell me your story of citizen activism, I encourage you to do so. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. While we're waiting, I want to tell you my own next story, and I've just been going through my life history here. Thinking of things that happened to me. And this is when I was about 13 years old. When I was about 13, my dad took me to London. It was really exciting to go across the pond, across the Atlantic Ocean. And he introduced me to Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park in London. And London, for many of you know this, maybe some of you don't, has set aside in Hyde Park, a park in London, a corner called Speaker's Corner, where everyone stands up on the, his or her soapbox, and a lot of times they wear little soapboxes, and fulminates on whatever issue he or she wants to. Could be political, could be religious, could be, well, anything. And I loved it. As a kid, I got to tell you, I really, really loved it because I've always been interested in politics and the mutual discussion and debate on issues. That's why I want John from Santa Fe to call back. By the way, apparently he said he is having phone issues and he will call back tomorrow. So stay tuned tomorrow and we'll hear more from John from Santa Fe. And I am curious to hear from the guy that has removed signs saying no firearms in their businesses. So John will call back tomorrow, hopefully, and we can talk to him then. Anyway, I was in London. I was in Speaker's Corner, and I was listening to people. And at age 13, I had some knowledge of politics, and I heard people talking about local London issues and people talking about religion. And then I heard someone talking about communism. Now, I'm a good liberal. I'm a proud liberal. I'm a proud progressive. But I knew that communism, at least as practiced in the Soviet Union, was a very dangerous thing. Again, this is... you know, this is the 1980s. This is prior to the fall of the wall, prior to the end of the Soviet Union. And this is still a country that has gulags, that puts people in prison for speaking out against the government. A country that, while beyond the worst of the Stalinist years, definitely under Brezhnev and all the others, Andropov and Chernov, and I forget all the names because they only lasted about a year or two. All of them was definitely repressing free speech. So this guy was going on and on about how communism was so wonderful and the Soviet Union was so wonderful. And I started saying to him, what if you talk against the government? What if you say something bad? What if, you know, and he was kind of ignoring me or kind of saying, you don't know anything. You're just a kid. I'm like, what do you mean I don't know anything? I just asked you a question. Kind of like I asked John a question. I said, you know, can you freely speak out in the Soviet Union? Anyway, one Londoner so enjoyed my pushback at age 13, and I was a little kid, 13-year-old. I'm not a very tall human being, and I was particularly small then, so I probably looked a lot younger. But he offered up his own soapbox, and he got off his soapbox and allowed me to get up there and preach about the dangers in the Soviet Union of speaking out, why I supported democracy, why I supported free speech. And I was having a ball, and I was on my soapbox in the center of London. Well, when the center, I don't know if it's the center of London. It felt like the center of London, felt like the center of the world. I guess I was an early talk show host even then, getting up on my soapbox, and at that time, you know, talking about the dangers in the Soviet Union. And the guy on the communist who was on his box came down off his box and was in my crowd, which was really cool, and started shouting insults at me. And then his friends started coming around, and they started shouting, and they started getting really angry, and they started approaching the box. And my father, remember how I said practicality trumps idealism in my family? My father literally picked me up off the soapbox and carried me off. And I'm like, wait, Dad, I'm not finished. And my arms are flailing. My arms and legs are waving. I'm like, wait, I want to respond. But my father saw danger in the eyes of these English communists and felt that for my own safety and for the fact that he'd never be able to explain to my mother what happened if something happened to me, he grabbed me off the soapbox. And that was the end of my first public speaking career. But yeah, I came back. So I come by the idea of speaking out naturally. I really do. And so by the time, you know, I got to law school and led a protest against an anti-Semitic speaker, someone who was a guy that came and basically preached hatred against Jews, I did my research. I led a protest at Yale. I got a lot of people to walk out. It seemed actually very normal to me to do that kind of thing because, as I said, as a little kid, I had often, I'll tell you something that my parents taught me at a very young age, and I've always been very grateful for this. They taught me that when you say something and everyone else says something else, evaluate it carefully because probably they're right. Really look carefully. You know, when you think one way and everyone else around you thinks another way, check it out. Make sure you're right because they may well be right. But if you have checked it out, if you're convinced that you are right about something, you can be right when the whole world is wrong around you. So if the whole world is wrong and you're right, you gotta speak out. When the Supreme Court stole an election in 2000, I spoke out, but tried to stop that election. And I've never stopped speaking since. We're going to talk more about citizen activism tomorrow. Maybe John from Santa Fe will call back in. 888-488-MARK. Follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. See you tomorrow.